Hello there. Today is Tuesday, December the 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democrats list their witnesses wanted for impeachment in the trial, as Republicans say there will be no witnesses.
If they're hell-bent on not voting in favor of articles of impeachment, no matter what the evidence suggests, then that's what they're going to do.
The U.S. envoy in Seoul with a message for North Korea on its threat of a deadline for the U.S. to make concessions.
Let me be absolutely clear. The United States does not have a deadline. We have a goal.
And it only took 25 years for this song to become a number one hit. Well, ahead of a full vote on Wednesday, the last step before moving to trial in the Senate, House Democrats laid out their impeachment case against President Donald Trump Monday. A sweeping report accuses him of betraying the nation and deserving to be ousted. What Democrats once hoped would be a bipartisan act is only the third time in U.S. history that the House will be voting to impeach a president, and that is now on track to be a starkly partisan roll call on Wednesday. No Republicans are breaking with the president, and almost all Democrats are expected to approve the charges against him. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer sent a letter to his Republican colleagues requesting several witnesses and documents that were blocked by the president to be submitted for the upcoming impeachment trial.
A good number of my Republican colleagues have said they believe the charges are serious, but there isn't enough evidence yet for them to make a decision. We believe these witnesses and documents would provide the evidence they're looking for.
So far, Republicans who hold a majority in the Senate say they will not cooperate. One of the president's loudest supporters, Senator Lindsey Graham, promoted that sentiment.
I want to end it. I don't want to legitimize it. I hate what they're doing.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is facing criticism for saying he is taking cues from the White House as he ensures Trump will not be 67 votes needed in the Senate to convict the president. Democrats complained he and other Republicans are not operating as impartial jurors. Joining us to talk more about all of it is Mark Rozell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you so much for being with us. So before we get into all that's transpiring, have Democrats made the case for impeaching the president of the United States?
I think the Democrats have indeed made the case. They've laid out the evidence. And, of course, much of the evidence has been directly acknowledged by the president who issued a transcript of the incriminating phone call, right, and did not deny that this took place, and then even called on other nation states to similarly conduct investigations of a family member of his potential political opponent for 2020. So the president hasn't been in denial about what happened, and many of the president's defenders are not denying the facts in this particular case. So I think it's been easy for the Democrats to establish their case. What should happen in a Senate trial is that the senators would hear the evidence and make a determination whether the case against the president has been proven, and not be thinking primarily about their partisan situation and the like.
And Democrats are pushing forward with the argument that even with all the evidence that they have, there's so much more that they don't have because the White House has blocked documents or testimony from any key witnesses who Republicans are now also not willing to produce.
Well, that's one of the challenges in this current situation. The president and his White House staff would not cooperate with the House investigation. They refused to participate. They refused to turn over relevant documents and other information that is very germane to the investigation. And so it does not look like a complete investigation by the Democrats, but that's because the White House has simply refused to participate. And so for that reason, the Democrats can legitimately make the argument that the White House has engaged in obstruction of Congress, given the fact that under our Constitution, Congress is the grand inquest of the nation. It has the right to conduct investigations, to look into allegations of wrongdoing in the executive branch and bring that information out in the open to the public and act on it if there is substantiation of allegations of wrongdoing in the executive branch. So the executive branch, in a sense, is saying we're just not even going to participate, as though somehow this process is not legitimate, puts the Democrats in a really difficult position.
What kind of precedent does this set?
It sets a terrible precedent, actually, because impeachment, of course, is such an incredibly serious matter under our constitutional system. This is only the fourth time in history we've had an impeachment inquiry. And so many people, I think, are just coming away from, many in the public, that is, coming away from this process with the perception that this is just another partisan game that's going on, and that the positions of the Democrats and Republicans are just entirely based on their own political situations and not on the merits of the case. And if that's the conclusion that people come to out of this process, it doesn't bode well for the future of the exercise of the impeachment power, because, and maybe the president is right on this one point, someday in the future, there'll be a Democrat in the White House, a Republican Congress, and maybe they'll want to play payback time. And that would just be horrible if we got into a situation of frequent impeachment episodes over, differences of policy and personality, which, you know, it's not in this particular case, but I'm just saying many people perceive it that way. And I think that just cheapens the whole exercise.
So if and when, which we expect it will happen, the Democrats will, in the full House vote, to send these articles of impeachment to the Senate, which requires the trial, the so-called trial. If Republicans continue to just basically not participate, just say they want to kill it as quick as possible, as Lindsey Graham said, and don't provide witnesses, and just basically just potentially exonerate the president without really giving this a trial, will Americans be satisfied that this process was carried out fairly, and will they take any of it seriously regardless of the results?
If the Republicans don't take this process seriously in the Senate, they just want to put a quick end to it without really reviewing the evidence carefully, I think the public would rightfully believe that the Senate did not take its constitutional responsibilities seriously. But there is a hard core of, you know, Republican base support for this president and for the Senate not to take this process seriously. So from a partisan standpoint, supporters of the president and of the Republican Party are not going to punish Republican senators for simply batting away the impeachment articles quickly. But again, it's really unfortunate because these are serious charges. They should be treated seriously. It sets a very bad precedent for the future for senators to just be treating this as though it's not a serious matter, and just moving quickly to put an end to it, as some of them are suggesting that they will do. So if they're hell-bent on not voting in favor of articles of impeachment, no matter what the evidence suggests, then that's what they're going to do. And the bottom line is they got the votes and they can do that.
All right, Mark Rozell. He is the dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Over the weekend, reports in the media indicated that the Trump administration intends to announce plans to reduce the number of American forces in Afghanistan by about 4,000. The U.S. military tells VOA it has not received orders to reduce troop levels, but officials in Afghanistan also tell VOA there are U.S. plans to withdraw thousands of troops from that country. Senator Lindsey Graham told reporters Monday during a visit to Kabul that Trump is planning a partial withdrawal of troops and will make an announcement this week. Graham said moving troops out of Afghanistan does need to be done the right way and at the right time.
It would be insane for America to rely on the Taliban to ensure that Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K doesn't come back in a way to represent a threat to our allies in the American homeland.
My colleague Steve Miller talked about it earlier with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad.
I approached, officials in Afghanistan, in the Afghan government, and also the military, the U.S. military stationed there. And what they told me is quite interesting, that presidential spokesman, a spokesman for the Afghan president, told me that this is an issue that has been under discussion between the Afghan government and the U.S. government, on the fate of American forces in Afghanistan, and that recently both the sides in principle agreed that 4,000 troops could leave in a gradual way Afghanistan. And then, obviously, when I approached the U.S. military spokesman, I was told that they have not received any orders about reducing the level of troops in Afghanistan. So we still are waiting from some kind of a version from the White House or Pentagon, whether this troop drawdown is in the pipeline. But it comes at a time, when we have these negotiations taking place between the Taliban and the U.S. Teams in Qatar, although they are currently temporarily have been paused. But this has been one of the issues, like the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan has been one of the issues on the table, because that's what the Taliban want before they cease hostilities in Afghanistan.
You mentioned the peace talks with the Taliban taking place in Qatar, but this is also coming after the Afghan papers and the United States officials cited in those papers saying that there was unclear and uncertain pathways to victory in Afghanistan. What are they saying more broadly about the United States' presence in Afghanistan?
It's a very complex situation, especially in the wake of these Afghan papers, that if the war has been facing challenges, I mean, if the United States and allies have not been able to break the stalemate that has persisted for the last 2 years, then obviously the only way out or to bring an end to this war, as President Trump has been, repeatedly saying, is through negotiation.
That's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Here are some of the stories we are following at VOANews.com. Turkey has deployed armed drones to northern Cyprus as tensions escalate. A Geneva refugee summit is grappling with issues of equity. 11 U.S. deaths have now been blamed on a major winter storm in the U.S. And a new study shows vaping raises the risk of lung disease, but less so than smoking. Find expanded coverage of these stories and many more at VOANews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A senior U.S. diplomat is in Seoul, South Korea, where on Monday he made a last-minute push for North Korea to stop its provocative actions and get back to nuclear negotiations. Steve Begun, the U.S. Special Representative for North Korea, is there just days after North Korea conducted two tests, apparently of engines for long-range missiles.
Let me speak directly to our counterparts in North Korea. It is time for us to do our jobs. Let's get this done. We are here, and you know how to reach us.
Pyongyang has promised to deliver an ominous Christmas gift if the U.S. does not offer more concessions by the end of the year. Joining us to talk more about these latest developments is Bruce Bennett, RAND Corporation Senior International Defense Researcher. Thank you so much for being with us. We're hearing about this last-minute effort to get North Korea back to the table before their so-called end-of-the-year deadline. What do you say about this?
Well, it's not last-minute. Begun has been saying very clearly that the U.S. doesn't take the end-of-the-year deadline that Kim Jong-un unilaterally declared. We just don't take that very seriously. This is a long-term negotiation process. That's what the North asked for, was no immediate reduction in its nuclear forces. So the U.S. has recognized that and compromised on that issue. And so Begun is in Seoul in an effort to coordinate with our Korean allies, our South Korean allies, but also to offer North Korea a chance of one more discussion. Unfortunately, the North Korean UN ambassador a week and a half ago said that the chances for negotiation on denuclearization were gone. They were dead. So the North is being unresponsive because Begun is not offering them wonderful compromises with no recompense from their side.
Well, was there really ever any chance that North Korea would give up their nuclear weapons, even if sanctions were lifted? Were they ever really serious about reducing or getting rid of nuclear weapons?
That is widely debated in the community, in the United States, in South Korea, and in other neighboring countries. There are many people who want to believe in peaceful coexistence, thinking that Kim is only interested in guaranteeing his regime's survival. And for them, sure, it's a possibility. He doesn't need the number of nuclear weapons he already has. He should be able to give up some of them. But if we look at his behavior since March of last year, when he said he was prepared to negotiate denuclearization, he has roughly doubled his nuclear damage potential, a combination of number of weapons and size of the weapons, and that suggests that he was never really interested just in survival. He's also interested in imposing Korean unification under North Korean control, and a serious nuclear force on his side gives him an advantage of doing that if he can break the U.S.-ROK alliance. And that is another of his objectives.
So are we back where we started from when President Donald Trump took office and tensions were pretty high back then? It seems like they're intensifying once again. It's not clear why North Korea is ramping it up the way it is, but it's probably not that different than it was at many other times. What are we to make of all of it?
So if you remember 2016 and 2017, North Korea carried out essentially an escalating campaign that in the community we refer to de-escalate, that you build pressure, planning at some point to offer an off-ramp to the other side, and they did. They said they'd go to the Olympics at the beginning of 2018, and President Moon of South Korea grabbed that and said, wonderful. Now they're doing the escalation number primarily focused on the U.S., and they're hoping that the U.S. will give them serious concessions. So they've kind of gone past the working with South Korea, so we're in a different situation in that regard. But North Korea still seems to want to be getting something for nothing or very little. They're not offering much to the president. They certainly didn't at Hanoi. They made it very clear at Hanoi that what they were offering was only selective reduction of the Yongbyon nuclear facilities, with no indication of which ones would be reduced, and therefore the president couldn't count on very much. That's where Kim seems to have been. How can he essentially get concessions from us by offering as little as he has to and performing on much less than even that? The bottom line is the big winner in this whole process has been Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un has gotten recognition as a major power by doing a summit meeting, two, now almost three, with President Trump. He's gotten recognition that he's probably a reasonable state rather than a rogue state. He's gotten the U.S. to suspend or seriously downsize all our military exercises on the peninsula. He's gotten a great deal. He's given very little.
All right, that's Bruce Bennett. He is a RAND Corporation Senior International Defense Researcher. Chile defended itself Monday against criticism it was too weak in presiding over international climate change negotiations, saying it did all it could, but that four big polluting countries got in the way. And speaking to reporters at the end of the summit Sunday in Madrid, climate policy specialist Alden Meyer with the Union of Concerned Scientists expressed disappointment.
Never have I seen the almost total disconnection we've seen here at COP25 in Madrid between what the science requires and the people of the world demand and what the climate negotiators are delivering in terms of meaningful action. The planet is on fire, and our window of escape is getting harder and harder to reach the longer we fail to act.
Joining us now to talk more about these end results, or lack thereof, is Mark Howden, director of a Climate Change Institute at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us. It sounds like the world leaders were not really listening to scientists or protesters outside of the conference.
There's a huge gap growing between the policy actions of governments particularly and what the publics of various nations are starting to expect. And that's why there was this, I think, general tension between the climate strikers and the protest movement and Greta Thunberg and others, and what actually occurred at the conference, which actually seemed to be relatively minimal progress.
Was there any progress that had any meaning at all to it?
There was progress in various areas. particularly in Article 6, which is the market mechanisms, there was a lot of clarity brought to the text. It wasn't fully resolved. There are still three areas which remain unresolved. They've effectively been kicked down the can, or cans kicked down the road to the Glasgow meeting. But there was also some progress in terms of the finance area and little bits elsewhere, but not a huge amount. But one of the big things, I think, was there was a developing group called the San Jose Group who starting to develop principles for how a market mechanism and trading system may work, and essentially saying this is a minimum requirement for a system that has integrity, has transparency, and is going to deliver outcomes. I think that was actually quite a big step forward.
As far as the actions that the scientists are saying governments need to take now to literally protect the planet, humanity, that it could be catastrophic if nothing is done, did any of the things scientists say needed to be done get done?
Not really. This meeting was ideally to resolve all of the what's called the rule book issues, those are how the Paris Agreement is going to be implemented. And next year was going to be the year for increased commitment. So 2020 is a schedule for increased emission reduction commitments from countries at Glasgow. But what happened was the rulebook issues didn't get resolved. Countries, by and large, didn't make additional commitments to reduce emissions. And so next year in Glasgow is going to become quite crowded. There's going to be all of those issues to be resolved in terms of, you know, the market mechanisms and loss and damage and finance, etc., as well as negotiations about increased commitments. And so, you know, that just makes next year's agenda much more crowded. Again, I think the real progress here came from other areas. So, for example, the EU declared, you know, an intention to go net climate neutral by 2050. Denmark made a big statement in terms of, you know, rapid emission reductions, and a whole range of businesses came to the party saying they were going to meet emission reductions which were consistent with the Paris Agreement. In other words, very rapid emission reductions. So there was some movement, but it didn't come from countries where, you know, they were raising their ambition to reduce emissions.
How concerning is it that another year will go by with any of these commitments still basically just a matter of something people are discussing but nothing happening, and these young people out there feeling frustrated, some of them, many of them, not old enough to vote to make change to who makes decisions regarding their futures?
Well, that's right. So every year we keep on emitting at our current rates. We chew through, roughly speaking, at the moment it's about 10% of our remaining carbon budget that's consistent with staying below 1.5 degrees. So, you know, next year it'll actually be a bigger proportion the year after that. And so just a few years down the track, every year that we delay, we'll be getting up to half and then all of the remaining emissions budget that's consistent with 1.5. And that's going to happen awfully quickly. And so every year that we stay emitting at high levels actually is really critical. And so we do need to move very quickly. There is a sense of urgency in this.
All right, that's Mark Howden. He is Director of Climate Change Institute at the Australian National University. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
It's summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, but if you're north of the equator, border crossings will bring you some warmth with our Psychedelic Sunshine Show. You'll hear from the best Californian musicians of the 60s, like Sonny and Cher, the Monkees, and the Beach Boys. Tune into Border Crossings on December 19th for the grooviest songs in the world, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Arabica coffee, the higher quality variety that Kenya grows, ends up in specialty stores and coffees in Europe and the United States. It thrives in moderate temperatures and high altitudes. But rising temperatures are scorching plants, making them vulnerable to diseases like coffee leaf rust. VOA correspondent Mariana Diallo reports.
Farmer Shadrack Mutisia has been growing coffee for 4 decades, but lately he's replaced most of his crop with banana, macadamia, and avocado trees. He says seeing so many diseases pushed him to make the change.
We only experienced a little bit of coffee rust, but now we see so many diseases, some so severe that they dry up the coffee trees. That is our biggest challenge now.
The average Kenyan temperature has gone up by 0.3 degrees per decade since 1985, according to the U.S. Agency for International Development. At the Mukuyuni Coffee Factory, farmers are learning techniques such as planting trees to shed their crop, and they are growing food crops alongside their coffee to add to their income. Shadrack Nzeki is the chief executive officer.
We are trying to educate the members, particularly on tree planting, in the areas where there are no trees. Particularly, we plant the indigenous trees and terrace our piece of lands to avoid soil erosion.
The farmers have also started a savings and loan cooperative group to enable members to have access to credit facilities and save up.
When the climate was good, the coffee production was doing very well. Then the production suddenly went down, and at the same time, our day-to-day needs still needed to be taken care of. So we came together to find a lasting solution to these problems brought about by climate change.
The country's coffee production is plummeting. The U.S. Department of Agriculture forecasts the 2019-2020 harvest will hit a 57-year low. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, it only took 25 years, but Christmas is coming early for Mariah Carey, the pop star's original holiday classic, All I Want for Christmas Is You, has finally reached the number one spot on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. That's right, 25 years after its release. Billboard announced that the song topped this week's chart, giving Carey her 19th number one of her career. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a fabulous day.